Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is an award-winning magazine editor. She's currently editor-in-chief of Empire magazine, having previously edited some of the most read titles in the UK and the US, including Time Out, New York and Shortlist. From the outside, it seemed like she was living the dream. However, this couldn't have been further from the truth. Her book, Coming Undone, is a brutally honest memoir touching on difficult themes including mental health, alcoholism and sexual abuse. Terry White, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Hello there, thank you.
Coming Undone had the most profound effect on me. It's shocking, it's compelling, it's sad, it's beautiful, it's all of those things. And of course, it's your life, it's your real life. And I wonder how difficult it must have been for you to sit down and trawl through all the awful memories, the shame and all the other emotions that you describe in the book.
I mean, it was very, very difficult. And I think a lot of people expect the process, the writing process, to be incredibly cathartic in some way. And although it's been, I think, helpful in the long run, I certainly wouldn't describe it as cathartic. I found it incredibly difficult to write, incredibly painful. I used to kind of only allow myself to write in a certain number of hour blocks because I found it incredibly upsetting. I was revisiting a lot of the memories, to be honest, for the first time in my entire life, you know, things that happened to me at 5, 6, 7, 8, writing about those for the first time when I was in my late 30s. So I did find it incredibly difficult, and it was quite a challenging process revisiting those, trying to dig out those memories, trying to ensure they were as accurate and truthful and real, really, while always kind of accepting that memory is fallible and flawed. That was the process that I went through. It was incredibly difficult, but hopefully what it's ended up in is a book that's incredibly truthful and as real as I could possibly make it.
Well, let's go back to those memories of 5, 6 years old. If you could start by setting the scene of your childhood, because your mother got married at 16. She had the best bum in the village. She was an attractive woman. And that was a problem, really.
Yeah, I mean, she, as you say, she was married at 16. She had my brother just before her 17th birthday. She had me when she was 18. I mean, I struggled to understand her perspective when I was younger, but now I'm an adult. I think, oh my God, she was a child. She was a child when she had children herself. And she made a lot of, frankly, bad decisions in terms of her relationship choices. You know, my dad, and this certainly wasn't her fault, my dad was incredibly violent, which I write about in the book, both to my mum and to me and my brother. And she left him when I was 2 years old. But what followed, unfortunately, was a succession of other men who were violent, either physically or sexually. And it kind of, there was one, I suppose, quite chaotic and extreme situation after the other, really.
And that was your own sexual abuse. You managed to get away, and I'm deliberately not going into this because I think people need to hear it, read it in your own words. You managed to get away from that first abuser. You ended up in a refuge. That kind of journey, fleeing to this alien place, how old were you at that time and what do you remember feeling about it?
So I was about 9 or 10, because actually the sexual abuse happened slightly earlier with another partner of my mum's, and then she met another man who she actually met because he wanted somewhere to hide after he'd attacked a man in town and put somebody into a coma, and my mum, for reasons that I don't really know, gave him refuge in our house, and that became a relationship she was in for a few years. And he was incredibly violent to all the family, and we did end up, and he was also sexually abusive towards me, and we did end up, as you say, having to go to a refuge in Wales after he strangled my mum. Thankfully she survived, but I think it became apparent to her that he was going to potentially kill her, really. I mean, he broke her fingers, he broke her ribs, he broke her nose. He was an incredibly cruel and violent and vindictive man, and that refuge was both, I suppose, a great comfort and a great relief, but also when you're that age and you've left the only place you've ever known, the only home you've ever known, we grew up in a tiny village. It was, you know, frightening to me, I suppose. We went to a refuge in Wales, the only refuge that had space for us. There was three of us kids and my mum. And it was both terrifying, but as I say, a great, great relief, because when you live in a house that is controlled and dominated by constant violence as a child, you live in pretty much constant fear every waking moment. So it was a strange mixture of both of those emotions.
And you talk about how that made you feel, how the sexual abuse made you hate yourself, how you wanted to disappear. There's one really affecting passage where you're putting a face mask on to try and obliterate your own features. And it's just so tragic, I guess, at the time, though. I mean, at the time, is that how it felt?
I think as women and as girls, we're always taught to kind of look for the blame and the fault within ourselves. And I definitely thought that. I remember thinking when I was abused by the second man, thinking, well, I must have done something. I must be giving something out into the universe that I don't even know about, that I have no kind of conscious control over, but I must be doing. Obviously, at that age, you don't realise that, you know, some men are predators and look for people who have been victimised before. So I just became convinced that it was about me and that there was something inherent as me as a girl that was making these things happen. And I think I genuinely thought the only way to make sure those things didn't happen in future was to make myself disappear. I was, you know, I used to stutter when I was a little girl. I was very, very chronically shy. And all of those things, I think, were coping mechanisms, because I thought if I became invisible, really, then I would be safer in the world and in a world of men.
And of course, what you did do was get out. The key to that was education. And again, back to your sort of writing style about this, one of the things I really loved about the book is how you kind of skid over stuff like that, like university and all the rest of it. Hardly any use of people's names. And yet we still have the vomit-flecked blood splatter on the page of the things that were really, really affecting.
Yeah, and you know, I think some people have said, why didn't I include the university years, the, you know, early years of my career, that kind of story of the journey out. And for me, that wasn't ever really the story. And I was saved by education, I was saved by work, I was saved, I suppose, by getting some kind of economic independence. But that wasn't the story, because that was the story on the surface. But the real story that was going on underneath it all was that however far I travelled, whether that was the 150 miles to university, whether that was the 200 miles to London for work, or whether that was the 3,500 miles I ended up traveling to New York, it doesn't really change the reality of the situation, which was internally and mentally, I was in a huge amount of pain. I was in a massive amount of chaos and crisis, and none of that ever changed, no matter what changed about my actual circumstance in terms of work, in terms of getting a degree. It was still all there in the background. So I deliberately made that choice not to include that stuff, which I think people did expect in a memoir. They kind of want that story. But I was really keen to emphasise to people that that isn't the path out. The path out has to be about your mental health and your, I suppose, psychological ability to come through the other side of that, and that isn't really impacted by a change in your physical and economic circumstance.
You write, I'd shrunk, I'd curled up inside myself, but I hadn't done it with passivity and compliance. I'd done it with patient fury, a coiled spring waiting for release. And you go on to describe the kind of fantasy revenge you'd have on these people that abused you. But in fact, I mean, what you ended up doing was abusing yourself. You cut yourself.
Yeah, so I did have, you know, very vivid fantasies of enacting physical revenge on these men, and one man in particular, the man who abused me when I was five. And that became an obsession for quite a long while. And I kind of thought that would be the solution. But, you know, there were practical kind of elements to that. But also, I would never really seriously consider that, because I'm not a violent person. I've seen the consequences of violence. And I think what you end up doing in that situation, when you are so impotent to be able to articulate to that person who has harmed you in such a way, the magnitude in which they've harmed you, I think the next step is always to turn it in on yourself. And I certainly did that. And it became about, you know, if I could hurt myself, if I could bleed, if I could cut myself, then I would in some way be able to cut the pain and the trauma out of me. And then when that kind of didn't work, you know, alcohol was the next thing, and trying to escape through that, because if I couldn't change my reality through harming myself, then I'd escape from that reality by another thing. But, you know, as cliched as it is, that there is no path out that way. Never, ever. I don't know anybody who's managed to found a path out that way. And it's only when you stop, it's not even blaming yourself, it's trying to resolve it by somehow harming yourself, and it's just a dead end.
Your path out was physical escape. Things got really bad in London with alcohol, with cutting yourself, with all the rest of it. And you left for New York.
Yeah, which, you know, I think if anybody's been through a lot of trauma and is running from pain, psychological, emotional pain, what you often do, and this is what I certainly did, is you run physically to places. So I ran to university. That wasn't quite far enough. I ran to London. That wasn't quite far enough. So then I was offered a job in New York, and I was convinced every opportunity seems like a new start and a new chance to fix things and fix yourself. And, you know, everybody says it, and it is absolutely 100% true, which is you take yourself with you. That's the thing that always follows you no matter where you are. And so when I arrived in New York, full of kind of, I suppose, hope and ambition that it would be different here and it would be different this time, it absolutely wasn't. And the reality of New York, I think, was that as a city, it is very intense, it's very claustrophobic, it's quite isolating. And I think what happened is it actually became the kind of worst place for me to be. And it became a bit of a tinderbox, really, of bringing my problems to a head.
And you write very affectingly about feeling totally alone there.
Yeah, I mean, I really did. It's funny because you think, how can you feel that alone in a city as densely populated as New York? How can you really, really feel alone when you're surrounded by people all day? I worked on a magazine. I edited a magazine with a team of about 50, 60 people. And, you know, I lived downtown, but I spent a huge amount of time either at work or completely on my own. I lived alone. I used to go to bars alone, drink alone, kind of wake up having blacked out alone. And I found it a very lonely city, to the point where you feel, you know, not even do I exist. Am I even alive? I became quite mentally unwell, and at its worst, I just wasn't even sure I existed anymore. And I felt like that was very much a product of being that ill within a city like New York.
You're right. And on the very bad nights, the worst ones, there's mess to be cleared up the next day, a mind to be patched up, a body to be fixed, a memory to be erased if it was ever captured in the first place. And time after time, we see this happening. You're waking up covered in vomit or takeaways or whatever it is. But what really interests me was what you said about science and not remembering things. What happens in a blackout? Why don't you remember stuff?
Yeah, so I remember I wrote an article for a magazine about drinking and how basically memories form or don't form when you're drinking excessively. And I interviewed a scientist who told me that actually the reason often you don't remember is not because you've forgotten. So everybody, I think, has had that thing where you wake up and you're desperately trying to find the memory. You're going, oh God, what did I do? And you're kind of on your hands and knees, scraping about, thinking, if I look hard enough, I can find the memory. And what that doctor said to me is actually the memory doesn't exist. Your mind is like a tape. And basically, when you drink to a certain amount, the tape just stops. And therefore, the memory doesn't exist, has never been formed in the first place. And I found this really exciting, to be honest, because I've been so terrified of all the things that I'd done when I was drunk and blacked out and I couldn't remember. And I would torture myself trying to work out how to retrieve these memories. And then I kind of thought, well, they don't exist in the first place, so it kind of doesn't matter. But I mean, you know, if that's the thing you're looking at to give you a bit of relief when you're drinking that much, then you're probably in quite a bad way. And I was, you know, at that point drinking to blackout probably 5 or 6 nights a week.
And yet, as you say, your career continued, work continued to go well. And one emotional release you found was through music.
Yeah, karaoke specifically. So I, you know, work was going brilliantly. It was very weird because I was very unwell out of work and I was drinking to blackout every night. But every morning I woke up, I put eye drops in, I took a scalding hot shower, I took Xanax, I had a coffee, and I was back at my desk by 8 o'clock in the morning. And I gave everything to work. I had no real life outside of it. We were winning awards, the magazine was doing really well. But actually, the more that improved, the more ill I was getting. And one thing that I kind of really clung to was weirdly karaoke. So there was a lot of karaoke bars in New York, and it was something that I really loved going to do. Sometimes I would try and convince colleagues or people I knew to come and do it with me, but more often than not, I would go to the same karaoke bar near my apartment on the Lower East Side. And I would go and I would request songs and I would sing by myself, and I would see them kind of sigh a little bit and sometimes roll their eyes when I went in because I was, you know, the drunk girl who came in every night alone and pushed them an extra $20 across the bar to get her song on quicker. But I don't know, there was something about the almost the, it was so overwrought, the songs that I was singing. It was kind of ridiculous, but I found this weird release in it. I was going around all day, either pretending everything was great at work or trying to hold it together at a bar when I was on my 5th or 6th or 7th martini, but actually standing in Chinatown, singing karaoke by myself, it was kind of the chink in the window where I could actually kind of open the release valve, I suppose.
What songs were you singing?
I was singing Celine Dion, It's All Coming Back to Me Now. I was singing Meatloaf. That's what I mean. It was like all massively overwrought 80s and 90s power ballads.
Fantastic.
I don't know. It was those, you know, those songs of longing and loss and heartbreak and devastation. All of those songs stitched together through, you know, heartbreak and pain. I found something in them that really allowed me to kind of have this strange release.
Now, we've got to talk about your hair.
Yes.
A huge construction.
Yeah, so I had a beehive when I lived in London, and it was kind of this quite, you know, small and compact blonde beehive. And then when I went to New York, I went through lots of hair changes, which, you know, sounds like a cliche that as a woman, when you are having difficulties, you kind of lose it with your hair, but I really did. So when I first moved there in the first 2 weeks, I had it dyed fire engine red from bottle blonde, which I'd been for about a decade, had a very extreme high fringe cut. And then I went to orange, and then I went to brown, and then I went to black. And I built this very big high beehive, which was a kind of this pad that I'd got from Boots when I was home, an ex-boyfriend's sock. And then I bought some weave from Harlem and I backcombed the weave and I clipped that in. And then I had my real hair over the top, and my hair just grew bigger and bigger and more vertical. And there are pictures of me in New York that I'm still staggered by, because my hair is literally vertical and massive and clearly completely, you know, something is not right. But I think, you know, it was a bit of a defense mechanism against the world. I something about the construction, and same with my makeup. I had, you know, black liner on, bright red lipstick. I think constructed a facade that made me feel a little bit safe and protected, even if it made me stand out, because I would walk in rooms and I would be the only person with a massive, massive, massive beehive and a painted on face. And so in one way I thought I was hiding, but in another way I was kind of making myself much more visible at the same time.
Absolutely. But you wanted to get rid of your physical self. You wanted to just not be alive, and you tried to kill yourself.
I did, yeah. So I was suicidal for a long time, actually, several months in New York. And I was obsessing about it. I was researching ways to do it. And I just thought at that point it was inevitable that that would be 100% what would happen. And there was not much I could do about it. And I overdosed on prescription pills and alcohol. And at that point was admitted to a psychiatric ward in New York.
And there's a lot in the book about your time in that ward, which is kind of darkly humorous as well.
Yeah, I admit, I didn't think it was. I said to somebody the other day, I said, oh, I'm sorry, there aren't many jokes in the book. And she was like, oh, no, the psychiatric ward stuff is really funny. Because it is, I mean, it's such an absurd situation. You never, ever think you're going to be in that situation. It's a little bit, I imagine, like prison, because you're locked in. It's not like being in hospital, because the doors were locked. We didn't have permission to go out. The 2 weeks I was in there, I, you know, didn't go outside, didn't feel the sun. And it was incredibly restrictive. You're told when to eat, you're told when to go to therapy, you're monitored constantly. So it's such an extreme situation that even just writing what happened factually, it seems kind of bonkers, because it is such a bizarre situation that I hopefully, you know, touch wood, will never find myself in again.
Now, you were begging for release almost from the minute you got in there. You had very good insurance, which meant that you were looked after very well. And one of the reasons you were allowed to be discharged was that you committed to going to AA meetings, which you did when you got out. And I just wonder, because there are various allusions throughout the book to a higher power, which of course is AA speak, if there is any kind of religious or spiritual aspect to your life, did you feel that you had help from beyond your immediate circle?
Well, so I did. I've always felt like something exists, whether I call that God or whatever. Ever since I was a child and things were very difficult at home, we lived directly opposite a church. And when things were really bad at home, I would kind of run over to the church. I would go to Sunday school. I would basically just hang around for as long as I could, because it was a place of safety. And actually, when I was really ill in New York, and, you know, there was a lot of suicidal ideation, I was drinking a lot. And I, you know, there's a passage in the book where I talk about ending up on the steps of a church in the West Village, and going in there hoping that somehow I would be saved by just the very act of walking in, that the priest who was holding the service would look at me and see how much pain I was in and somehow reach out to me. Obviously, that didn't happen. But I think I was always searching for help from whatever that higher power was. But it was something I struggled with AA, because AA is built around a complete submission to that higher power. You have to admit that you have no control over your life. And there were certain aspects of AA that I found very challenging. And, you know, I know people whose lives have pretty much been saved by AA, but it certainly wasn't something that fit with me. And I think, you know, what I discovered, because alcohol wasn't just my problem, there was self-harm, there was so many different things going on. And the fundamental problem I had was that I wanted to die. And I was just had a variety of different ways I was trying to go about it. And what I realized was the only way I could possibly come out of the other side in any way, shape or form was to be able to want to live.
Which you do eventually. But again, this is something I feel that our listeners should read about. You decide to go back to London. And before you leave, there's this hugely moving piece about a woman in the subway, and you describe her. And what you don't say, but of course is very obvious, is that without your insurance, that could have been you.
Yeah, I mean, that was always very apparent to me in New York, that everything was decided upon economic lines, upon class lines, the value you were given, the help you were given, the care you were given, all depended on your job, your status, your, you know, ability to get a hold of money. I was very lucky, as you say, that I had good insurance with my job. But I would ride the subway in New York and you would see people who were very clearly mentally ill, who had no access to treatment on the subway. And as you say, there was an incident the week before I left New York where I was on my way to work and a woman got on who was clearly having an episode. I'm not sure what mental illness she was suffering from, but she was clearly very unwell. And she took down her jogging bottoms and she started to defecate on the subway floor. And I just found it incredibly upsetting. And some people on the subway just got off and moved on to the other carriage because that's very New York, you know, it's just an inconvenience. Other people were laughing and filming her on their phones. And I just found it the most dehumanizing, upsetting thing, because that seemed to me to encapsulate a lot of what is problematic about New York, especially the US healthcare system, you know, the way that only certain people are allowed proper care or given access to proper care. And I was very, very lucky. And actually, one of my regrets is that I didn't properly engage with the treatment that was offered to me, because I was so obsessed, as you say, with getting out, because I felt like I was trapped in there, I was imprisoned in there. I didn't know how long I would have to stay in there. I felt very panicked. I was a very long way from home. And instead of engaging with what was on the table and trying to actually, you know, find out what was wrong or how to start to get better, I just wanted to get out the door. And I think I was incredibly privileged to be offered the treatment I was. And that certainly isn't the case for everybody.
Would you call yourself better now?
I suppose so. I think it's always a process and it's always an ongoing thing. So the book ends just as I moved back from London the day after. And a lot of people have got in touch with me saying, oh, you know, why didn't you write about getting better in London? And I've had a son since I finished the book and met a partner. And because that, again, isn't really the story. Having a child and meeting a man doesn't ever fix you. What happened when I came home is that I actually properly engaged with mental health services, took medication for the first time, had therapy. And it's something I'm still doing now. I still see a psychiatrist. I have to be very vigilant with my own behaviour, with my own kind of, I suppose, the habits that I developed to survive beforehand. They're always just lying under the skin. And my mental health is something I'm going to struggle with my entire life. Trauma is for life. You never, ever get over the kind of trauma that I went through. And all you can ever do is learn to live with it, really, and to not let it completely eviscerate your life. And I feel like I'm there now. I feel like it won't destroy my life in the same way it almost did. But I think, you know, it's going to be something that I'm going to have to work on forever. And so it was really important to me that the book didn't feel like a resolution and a redemption at the end, because, you know, there is no such thing, I think, in circumstances like mine where everything is suddenly okay and you're fully better.
And finally, Terry, I mean, here you are, you're editor-in-chief of Empire. You've got this fabulous job. You've got your own little family. You are in the process of healing. What has this writing this book meant for you, and has it affected the way that people relate to you?
Well, I was always, one of the things I was most nervous about writing the book was, I suppose, revealing who I really was, because professionally I'd always been quite tough, very dedicated, very professional. I'd never allowed my personal problems or private problems to impact on my career. And, you know, obviously I just thought, well, if people know that I was abused, if people know that I've had mental health problems, if they know I've tried to commit suicide, if they know I've been in a psychiatric ward, they're going to think differently about me. Maybe they won't respect me as much. Maybe they won't trust me as much. Maybe they will think that I could be chaotic. And those things were a real concern. And then actually, since the book came out, it's been something of a relief, because people may think that privately. I mean, nobody's said that to me, and they probably wouldn't, but I feel relieved that I'm not hiding anything anymore, because, you know, this book didn't come out until I was 39, 40, and that's a long time to hide what's happened to you and who you really are, and it's quite exhausting, and you end up developing kind of almost multiple personas just to be able to survive and get through day to day and get through life. And so to kind of bring all of those things together and just be, I suppose, without wanting to sound really cheesy, with just being the person that I am and being truthful, has been a huge, huge, huge relief. And the book has been an incredibly important part of me reconciling who I am today and who I was before and what I went through.
Terry White, thank you so much for talking to me. The book is raw, it's visceral, it's funny sometimes. It's an absolutely compelling read, and I would urge you to get hold of Coming Undone, a memoir by Terry White. It's published by Canongate Books and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull, Charlie Filmer-Court and Steph Chungu. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.